Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing. From cake
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with George Weld of the preeminent egg restaurant in Brooklyn. Looking back at my archives, I was lucky enough to photograph an egg many, many years ago for Edible Brooklyn, spending a day in the life of, but I think I extended that to a week, maybe a month. I mean, I found myself to be an impermanent but permanent fixture in there for a little bit because I was so intrigued by not only the food you were making, but you as a person, and what you kind of did for Williamsburg. You know, there's a draw. There's a slowness in the mornings to that strip of Bedford Ave, and you got people to wake up.
Yes. I think we gathered some people in who were otherwise have been sort of drifting around, not sure what to do with themselves in the mornings, and we weren't sure when we started whether anyone really was going to be up. It was just sort of it was really a shot in the dark because there's no... Most people who I talked to about it said, nobody in Williamsburg wakes up before noon. And I said, yeah, you're probably right, but I want to cook breakfast, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. You were at a transitionary period of your life, too, having come from you know, a more corporate job. And this was really your first foray into restaurant work. Did you feel kind of as, not aimless, but lost as maybe the before noon crowd?
Well, I actually felt, I mean, I'd worked in restaurants in high school and in college, and it's true, I'd spent all the time I had after that working to try to get away from it, in a sense. I wasn't consciously trying to get away from it, but I just figured, you know, I'm off to college, I'm off to grad school, I'm going to end up doing something very cushy in a in an office lined with books somewhere someday. And I kept coming back to cooking personally for myself, and, you know, I worked for a little while as a temp. I worked for a cookbook mail order company outside of Boston when I was in grad school, and just being surrounded by new cookbooks all the time, I was just like, I really love this. This is really exciting to me. And even though I'm in grad school for creative writing, like, what excites me about, I'm just as excited to come to this job and look through cookbooks as I am to go to school and do the thing that I'm, you know, I supposedly love to do, but it's too hard. You know, I don't want to do it. The hours are crazy. I don't want to live that way. It's too intense and I'm not cut out for it. And I really think I just kept trying to push myself away from it and push myself away from it. And I tried a couple other careers. I tried to be an academic. I worked for a .com for a little while. I did freelance work, writing and design for a while. And all of it felt unsatisfying to me. And so when Egg started, it felt a little bit like an inevitability. Like, you know, you ran and ran and ran and ran, and now you're back to where you started. And as soon as I went in, and it's just something about, like, being in the pressure of a line and being, you know, next to the heat of a stove, and making food and trying to get it right every time felt fulfilling in a way that nothing I had done professionally had ever felt before. And it felt a lot more fulfilling than the previous restaurant jobs I'd had felt, because, you know, I was cooking food that I believed in, where in the past I was working at, like, Pizza Hut Express or, you know, a frozen shrimp place.
But yeah, you mentioned running and running and running and kind of this rote monotony of, you know, doing a job. It feels a lot like most Southern literature, this, you know, passive escapism. Having a PhD in literature, what kind of books did you read? Were they fiction? Were they nonfiction?
Well, to be clear, I'm a PhD dropout, so I'm ABD. I didn't finish my dissertation. It's part of my endless flight. But I was studying American poetry, and the weirder the more difficult, the better for me. I was really interested in that. I was really interested in critical theory. So the books I'd been reading were extremely abstract, and I think in a way, I remember reading a book of Paul Auster's where he talks about, I think it's called The Art of Hunger. He talks about being a translator in France for a while and living there with his wife and how poor they were and how one night, they were so poor, all they had in the house was some flour and onions and maybe an old tin of anchovies and some olives that were stuck in the back of the fridge. So he went down and made a dish that I can't remember the name of and I couldn't pronounce even if I could. But, just caramelized onions on a pastry tart with some anchovies and olives. And just, it was like such an unbelievably delicious and transformative meal for him. Because it's like, I had nothing. I had just like scraps in my pantry and I made this beautiful, delicious thing. I went straight from reading that book in my little study in my house down to the kitchen and made that. It's like that for me was like a moment of like, I can read all this incredibly abstract stuff and it's interesting to me intellectually, but it keeps pushing me back to the kitchen because I love working with my hands. I love being, with this sensual pleasures and sensual like pains as well. Like there's something to being physical that cooking gives you that even the most like thrilling intellectual ventures don't.
It's kind of great when you transitioned to Sparky's All-American, is that what it was called?
I think it was called.
The tactility was kind of tested out. It was, just mornings. You were kind of renting the space from a friend. And did you see the phenomenon that egg was happen? Did you expect it to happen as quickly as it did?
No way. of course I hoped it would happen. And I wanted it to happen. But my fallback plan, which I think I've, 90% of my rational mind thought was where I would end up is I would do it for a year or two. I would spend, a certain amount of money that would be considerably less than I would have spent on culinary school. And I would gain the experience of working in a kitchen. I would gain some business experience. And so maybe I'd get to go work in somebody else's real restaurant after I'd, experimented with running my own. I definitely didn't think it was going to be, I didn't think I'd be sitting here 10 years later having this conversation with you.
Yeah.
But I'm happy that I am.
I mean, I'm glad you did not have to kind of befall on your fallback plan and,
You
forged ahead and, it wasn't easy.
Right.
No restaurant, no venture, nothing is easy, but it's almost about that challenge. It's about trying to figure out what's best for you and best for that community that's so engaging and, Egg has been a stalwart for a community, and it's simply based around breakfast.
Yeah.
Why did you think that was the important meal to kind of build your business around?
Yeah, well, I've always been, to my mother's and then my wife's chagrin, a morning person. I wake up early and I'm ready to go. I'm as good as I'm going to get first thing in the morning. So I always loved breakfast. I loved breakfast at night too, but I especially love mornings, and I love, having a minute to sit down and enjoy something good to eat then. Nobody was doing it. In New York especially, I think you could get breakfasty food on the weekends at brunch, but if you wanted to have there weren't that many places that did it in the city. It just felt like a wide open field in a way. And it was one of those things where you're like, is everybody not doing this because nobody wants it? Or is everybody not doing this because the excitement is in dinner? The big thrills are, the glamour and the glory are all about making incredible dinner places. So it was sort of a test. It was also an opportunity. The arrangement that I have with Sparky's allowed me to be open in the morning. So it was a great fit. But it was also sort of inevitable given the hours.
I've been guilty of grab and go egg sandwiches. I've been guilty of sitting at a diner and wondering where my food is, even though I only ordered it 2 minutes ago.
Right.
And, you know, at a point of where slow food was the predominant, at least in our kind of demographic of restaurants, breakfast was always thought of as fast.
Right. Yeah, and that's still something that we struggle with. I mean, egg is, at the beginning when I was doing most of the cooking, egg was unusually slow, even for a slow food restaurant. But, you know, the things that we do take time. And, you know, there have been times when you know, if somebody orders over easies, we'll sit there and go through several sets to try to get them right, because they'll break or they'll overcook them. You know, sometimes eggs don't cook at the same rate. So, you know, the egg on the left will go to medium, while the egg on the right is still undercooked. So we'll ditch them and try again. And for me, it was sort of a way of making the whole process feel important and feel real, and to give it the kind of, to treat it with the kind of seriousness that I felt like it deserved. But it drove people nuts. They're like, I want to eat now. I want to go. Like, this is crazy. I just wanted toast and some eggs. Why has it taken me 15 minutes to get it or 20 minutes to get it? But I think people have, you know, I think people have figured it out a little bit. We've always kind of pushed away, not pushed aside, but like we haven't focused on takeout food, because we know it takes a while, and really the whole point of it is to sit down and chill out. I also eat stuff quickly to, you know, I'll grab stuff at a deli sometimes, and when I'm getting on the train, everybody has to do it. It's part of life. But if you have the time, if you have 40 minutes to sit down, you know, I feel like go ahead and sit down and be there and enjoy it and chill out a little bit.
Well, I mean, there's also a willingness to wait for the quality of food that you serve. They're eggs. Inevitably, they are eggs, but the patience you took with those, the trial and error, and I only wish it was someone like Tom Wolfe that said you have to crack a few eggs to make an omelet. But again, you took that time to be able to develop the exact kind of experience you wanted. And and that's why people are willing to line up for hours just to have eggs Rothko, you know, ham, and, you know, country ham biscuits.
Right.
It's not just craveable, but it's comforting in its patience.
Yeah, I think it's especially the case now that we moved last year from the original space that was really small to a much bigger space, that I think makes it easier for people to sit and relax and, you know, come in at 7:30 and stay till 9:30. And so we see a lot more of that. And one of the things that's exciting about it to me as somebody who lives here and somebody who has a restaurant is just to see people, you know, one, you get to see people wake up. Two, you get to see people, you know, interact in a very relaxed way with their friends. So sometimes they're dreaming up ideas for, you know, a business or trying to figure out some part of a script they're working on, or, you know, figuring out how they're going to, you know, sometimes they've just come from an all-night recording session and they're sort of debriefing about that or just trying to decompress from that. It's a great time of day to see people be, you know, and be alive. And I think it's one of the things that I don't think I appreciated as much at the beginning, but now that I've seen it over and over again and I can sort of step back, like, it feels like an amazing gift to me to be able to be there in people's lives at that time of day and give them a little space to take it slow and take it easy and think things up.
As creepy as it sounds, I don't think I'd mind waking up with you next to me. I mean, that may sound, that did sound, I'm going to listen to that again and regret saying that, but I'm willing to wake up for egg.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk the history of hash and odes to country ham. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
And welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here again today with George Weld of Egg Restaurant in Brooklyn. The History of Hash, Odes to Country Ham. This book does have, you know, that American poetry that you were hoping for. Yes. Be it in head notes or intros. Yeah. But why do you wax poetic about these things? What do they actually mean to you?
Well, I think they tap into something really deep. And I don't think I can explain it exactly, I can't articulate it that well. I you know, when I smell a country ham, when I smell one of Nancy Newsom Mahaffey's hams, it takes me in my memory to a place that, like, I can't even be sure that I've ever been. But I think they feel so connected to something. And, you know, my grandmother had a farm in Virginia where they, you know, cured and smoked country hams. And I've smelled that. I never got to try one of their hams, but I smelled the inside of that smokehouse, and I have a sense of that kind of, like, a building that's been smoked over and over and over again. And it's almost like it smells like, it just feels corny to say this, but it feels like it taps into some, like, seam of history that, you know, I am at the end of, you know, and not the terminal end of, but it comes through me onto, you know, whoever's next. But those flavors and smells that have come down from generation to generation, like, people have been working on those things for so long, it really feels like they're, you know, you're regretting the saying that you wished you woke up next to me in the morning. But this is, like, it feels like something that I wish I could articulate better. But it just feels like it just connects with such a powerful thread of history. And it's a visceral history. Like, it feels like I can taste food that my grandfather ate or that my great grandfather ate. It hasn't changed that much. And I don't know, when the restaurant opened, I used to get unbearably homesick. We'd be sitting there, like, cooking ham and bacon and grits and eggs, and Amy Lou Harris would be playing on the stereo, and I would just be, like, on the verge of tears. It's like, I can't take it. It's too, like, I get so, I mean, I'm a terrible sap to begin with, but, I mean, it was just, it's a very, it just feels like a home, I guess. Like, but, like, my home and my mother's home, my grandmother's home, it's just like a collapsed version of history all in this one little moment.
You know, that sentiment is shared, you know, by having been there many a times, but I'm sure by the greater community that you support and, you know, loves egg in the same way that you love this abstract concept of, you know, what that food is to you. And there's a legacy there. You know, it's not to say that you don't know who Edna Lewis is.
Right.
And that you don't sour milk with a little bit of cider vinegar to make your biscuits. Uh-huh. You know, there are those threads. And what is the importance of having that heritage and being able to carry that on in kind of a modern setting?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, for me, it's there's a very personal element to it. And, sort of guiding principles I held for myself when I started Egg was I want to make food that my grandmother would recognize and acknowledge as food. So nothing too weird and nothing too fancy. Just, you know, if my grandmother came in here today, would she say, this looks familiar to me? And it's not because I've, you know, worship my grandmother like an Italian chef, but I loved her and I loved what I had inherited from her sort of culturally. Or maybe more spiritually than culturally. So for me, it's important in that way. I think in a broader sense, it's complicated because, you know, the legacy of this food is very complicated. You know, Southern food is not, you know, it's not simple. We don't, like, a lot of the food that we cook and eat has a tortured history or has a complicated history that, you know, is morally complex. And I think one of the things that food can do is help us think about those things in a way that's not too upsetting, or and it reminds us that history exists. I remember having an exchange once with a customer who had written me to complain about the way that we described our grits as antebellum style, and she said, you know, I really find that term antebellum offensive. It you know, it glorifies a time in our country's history that's shouldn't be glorified. And my response was, you know, I get it, and I'm happy to take that word off the menu because I don't want to glorify that time, but I also don't want to erase that history and pretend that, you know, this is just the equivalent of polenta. You know, what's behind this food matters, and, you know, I'm not going to figure it out on my own, but I would love to be part of. I think it's important that we have it and that we work on it and that we think through it. I think that's something that's going on. But, you know, like Ed and Lewis's home was, you know, not that far from my grandmother's farm, but the town that she lives in is not on the map anymore. Her living situation down the road from our place was very different from my grandmother's. I don't think that's, you know, we talk about how awesome it was to have Ed and Lewis here as a communist organizer and an amazing chef, and that she left these amazing books and had an incredible collaborative relationship with Scott Peacock, and those things are all great, but what's behind all this is intense and needs to be reckoned with. And so I think the food means that too. It means pay attention. Where do we come from? What are we doing?
It's a lot to contemplate over breakfast.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I've always, you know, the way I felt with everything with breakfast is, you know, people want to eat, and that's great. Let them eat. Let them be by themselves. Let them be who they are. And let's not try to impose anything on them, whether it's, you know, the provenance of our ingredients or, you know, the ethics of our labor practices. It's just have a good meal, and we hope the food speaks for itself. But I would love it if, you know, because people got excited about the food, they investigated a little bit further or, you know, came back and, you know, got to have more of a complicated conversation about it.
Well, part of what your book is about isn't just waking up for breakfast, but like you said, of that provenance, of those ethics and ideologies behind it, you wouldn't have started Goatfell Farms if you didn't believe so much about, you know, that reach, that arm and leg of your company, those practices.
Yeah.
When did you start that farm, and why did you invest in that kind of, you know, business venture?
Yeah. Well, we started that, I think, in 2008 or 2009. And it was really just, I mean, it felt like just an extension of cooking in a sense. You know, where do our ingredients come from? When does the preparation process start? It starts at the seed, at least. It may start before the seed. It starts in the soil. So part of it was that, like, where, you know, if we want to make these ingredients that we're treating so simply really sing, then it would help to have them come from some place where we can control every element of it. But it was also a lot of curiosity. It was all kind of a, you know, one of the things that brought me into food, has always made me love food, or is being outdoors and understanding the connection between having outdoor spaces and having both the woods. And I mean, it's, you know, this from Michigan, I imagine, like, just the, you know, the beauty of being outdoors connects immediately to food, because this is where the stuff that you eat comes from. And you know, we get to have that food because people have preserved this land and made it and worked it and made it survive and made it support food for such a long time. So being outdoors and being part of turning land into farms and maintaining it that way, it's felt really important to me. So it's really been an kind of an intense educational experience. To call it a business venture is kind of a stretch. I mean, it's been a business lesson for sure. But a lot of that lesson has been what I wanted, which was how hard is it to do this work? How, you know, what are the people who are able to provide us with a consistent supply of really good vegetables? What do they go through to make that happen? I have a much better sense of that now, and everyone who works at the restaurant has a much better sense of that now than we ever would have done if we had just been, you know, planting our flower box in the front window.
Yeah, well, I mean, because you also have to be there now. I don't mean you personally as a manager, but Egg has to be there for Brooklyn and beyond. I mean, you've been such a permanent fixture for over a decade that I'm not sure we know what to do without you. So there's a great, you know, amount of responsibility on your show. Not to give you more, because I already know how much you do, but you are, you know, our local Edna Lewis in a sense, because you carry those strings. You carry, you know, those stories, and even though you can order an egg, you know, poached and scrambled and pickled and deviled and, you know, any iteration that there is under the sun, we can do that because you took the time to listen and contemplate and, you know, reassemble and show us again the importance of, you know, waking up.
Well, thanks. I hope so. I would love to be, I mean, I would love to, this community has been amazing to me. The restaurant has worked here. I've raised kids here. I've, you know, made a life here for over a decade, and I love it. And as it changes, I would love to be, like, I would love to be thought of as a big part of the community. I feel that way about some families that we interact with, and it's been amazing to watch. You know, I've seen people start dating and then get married and have kids and just go through that whole process, and they keep coming back and they keep coming back. And to be a part of, as I said earlier, to be part of somebody's life in that process is a real gift, and I feel really lucky to have been able to do it.
I took this picture of Eggs Rothko.
Yep, the iconic photo.
Let's explain what Eggs Rothko is.
Well, Egg Rothko is a piece of Amy's brioche, which is this incredibly rich bread that we slice in about an inch thick, cut out the middle of, put an egg in, cook it, and we cook it on the flat top so the egg stays runny. We cover the whole thing with sharp cheddar cheese and stick it in the broiler. And that's it. We serve it with a side of boiled tomatoes and some meat or vegetables, if you like. And it's very simple. It's, you know, got some, it's incredibly rich. It has a little bit of acidity from the sides, but it has grabbed people's palates and their imaginations, and they keep eating it over and over again.
I mean, I know the art reference, what was, you know, the initial reason for putting that? What was your, you know, affectionate term for this dish prior to Egg Rothko?
I think I thought of it as like a toad in a hole. And a friend of mine who had helped me sort of plan the menu and helped me sort of think through the whole rest, she was one of the owners of Sparky's, is actually I think she's a great, great niece of Mark Rothko. And I don't remember exactly what the story was, but as I remember it, it was that he loved this dish, or he loved some version. It was his like go-to breakfast. And so that's where the name came from. I thought it also looked vaguely like a Rothko when it broke and the yolk was spread across the bottom. And I love his painting. So it all felt good, but it's sort of an anomaly on the menu because nothing else is named. Everything else is just described as it is, you know, two eggs or.
Well, it's funny hearing people actually reference it at Egg Rothko and not Toad in the Hole, Farmer's Basket, right. Whatever else it is. But there's this association. There's this, you know, cerebral thing that happens because most people have had that dish at one point in their life.
right.
And it's called so many things. And it's you don't make it for yourself.
Right. So
it's, you know, your parents or your grandparents. Like, it's always this elder that presents this to you. And it's this gift. And the egg's coddled. And, well, I don't mean coddled eggs. But, it's held in this way that is just the same way I think you have a relationship with the person that cooked it for you. And it wasn't hard to photograph that and have that kind of be bigger than just the image itself, because that's kind of what that represents.
It was a great photograph. We pay a little homage to it in the book, actually. So
excellent. Well, I constantly pay homage to what you did here.
Well, thanks.
And everyone should buy this book, Breakfast Recipes to Wake Up For. George, thank you so much for being here. And
thank you,
I look
Michael.
Forward to seeing you for years on end.
Oh, thanks.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host here, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.